Cynthia is going to be a special guest today, and Cynthia Chung has written a book that you got a copy, and I think a lot of the viewers have picked up their copies by now. It's The Empire in Which the Black Sun Never Set: Anglo-American Fascism in the 20th Century. So what are the origins of it? By going into something that very few people, I don't know anybody who's done it the way she has, that looks at the real roots. We're told today in universities, this is the commonly accepted hypothesis that fascism is the natural outgrowth of nationalism. That's the actual official theory that is promulgated amongst all dominant transatlantic universities that I know of. By having nations, nations will naturally want to expand, subdue their neighbors in some Hobbesian battle for limited resources. That's just the nature of nation states. And if you just let them be nation states long enough, they'll eventually become empires, and the empires will necessarily become fascist. And that's the nature of things. That's the nature of the laws, the very laws of the universe. Why did Hitler happen? Why did Mussolini happen? Mussolini happened because of nation states. And the idea then is the solution as well. Just if we got rid of nation states and just had a one world government, then we'd never have wars again. That's something that's out there. So Cynthia's book really nips that in the bud very nicely. There's a few things I'm going to show people before we bring Cynthia on. The big theory, the total fallacy that Cynthia debunks, is that nation states are the cause of fascism. We're going to have her talk about today, like what actually does cause fascism. What's the correct theory about the origins of fascism? Cynthia Chung, hello.
Hey, Cynthia.
Hi.
Welcome
Glad to
back.
be, very glad to be back. Thank you for having me.
Cool. Yeah, this is going to be fun, and I think very important because, again, the work that you did the heavy lifting, you shared your discoveries, you made it very transparent. It's a thick read. This, again, for those who don't have this book, pick it up. It's going to be in the description box under this video, The Empire in Which the Black Sun Never Set.
Good book.
Oh yeah, very good book. And I bet in the second edition is Gordon back. Good book. Is the testimonial. Yes, at least Patrick had it.
That's right.
So one of the dangers, though, is that the social engineers managing society, the reason why they often get away with this line that nation states are the outgrowth, or fascism is the outgrowth of nation state, is that they actually get victims, their target victims, to actually act fascist, whether it's on the left or whether it's on the right, by socially engineering our emotions, playing us against each other in false oppositions. We're often induced, and it's happened so many times. It's dizzying to look at the case studies of human beings who've fallen for these traps, where violent radical extremism becomes the only source of possible action for people on both left and right extremes. In a narrative mix that paints the other as evil. We are virtuous, we are good, they are evil. And you've got this like idea that if we are absolutely virtuous, if we are the hand of pure virtue and goodness, we see the left wokest doing it all the time. We see examples of this also on the well-hearted conservatives also falling for this trap. Then it you know we can be the weapons exacting God's will, even if it means bloodletting. And something that a friend of mine passed on to me was something that's gone viral on TikTok, 2033, and Gen Z is taking power with. For those who missed that, that was the caption. and the person who promulgated it was a New Templar account. Some of the comments below this video are things like, it's just wild to see. And again, this thing got a lot of views. Templar Knights just doing little screenshots. Templar tweet here. What's this? Oops. Got little screenshots from Kingdom of Heaven with the Crusader King. I got this one here. It's right below it. There it is. Ah, these things not responding to my thumb. If I have to, I will hurt people. I don't care. I love my country. I love my people. I love our principles, and I love for what we stand for. Grammar is terrible. I hate what they made of us. We have a rich history, great culture, and I will stand for it till the end of my days. Germany for the people. and the people for Germany. Long live Germany. And it goes on, you know, people are like citing Lord of the Rings as their, as their way they're expressing themselves. The most aware generation is Generation Z, to the point that it can differentiate between good and bad and what is beneficial to its country in creating a better world. Bondor calls for aid. So you got like this weird propaganda, and if you look for it, you kind of see it everywhere, this nudging. Got Nick Fuentes as well.
I'm so sick of it. I'm honestly sick to my stomach. I can't even tell you. Where have the Romans gone? Where have the white people gone? Where are the Catholics? Where are the Christians? Where is our home? Where is our tribe? Where's our nation? Where's our fucking family? That's how we all feel. We are all orphans. We are orphans. We are slaves. We are second-class citizens. That is what we are. We are a formerly proud and mighty and glorious and great people that are now occupied and subjugated and captive. And make no mistake about it, that is precisely what it is, as evidenced by these symbols.
He goes on for a while longer, as he often does. But, you know, the messaging is clear. Where are the white people? Where's the tribe? Where are the Catholics? Where's the Romans? Right. And the idea, the narrative that he's pushing is, look, we are the oppressed people. We are now the second class citizens because of the immigrants. The immigrants are everywhere. And, you and I, we talked about this last week and the week before a little bit, how this nudging is happening all over England, too, with, Crusader flags of St. George slaying the dragon all over the place. There's this nudging, and I smell intelligence agencies. I smell social engineering, and I smell potential bloodletting that could involve a lot of good people losing their heads and acting like the will or the weapons of those who would actually like to see them become murderers and get murdered. So, Cynthia, you've positioned yourself pretty well to talk to this danger. How do you see the world right now and the danger of this Crusader revival?
Well, I think I'm going to say something kind of indirectly first, and then we're going to get into a lot of details as to how history is really repeating itself from what we had already gone through in the early 20th century. But, there's a lot of game theory involved in this as well. And I'm going to do a short rant on game theory before I get into any history, because I think people have been like really indoctrinated watching so many Hollywood movies, which are, post-apocalyptic, dystopic, futuristic type scenarios. And there are a lot of movies like Maze Runner is a notable one, but countless, and especially with the younger generation, this is a lot of what they've been put through, which is that you're in a post-apocalyptic situation where you have a situation of scarcity, or you there's only so many survivors that can get through one phase and then the next phase and so forth. And there are certain parameters to the game, and you have to just go by those parameters as quickly as possible. Be as innovative and creative as you can, maybe. But at the end of the day, those parameters are set in place. And you might have to do some bad things. Actually, what's that really famous Japanese TV show that is a
Squid Game?
No, not Squid Game. It's Alice in Borderland. Something like that as the title, really popular amongst 20-year-olds and younger. And it's like the sort of, you're not sure if it's aliens. I only saw the first season, but you can get into a game and if it's spades or it's hearts or it's whatever, it's going to give you a certain kind of idea of what kind of game it is. So if it's a game of hearts, there's only one survivor for that game, and you have to basically kill everybody, in that game. But there's different styles based off of the suit of the card. But it's these kinds of scenarios that we're really brainwashed into accepting. And I think people are totally getting played right now, because everyone's getting squished into a very small space. There's increasingly less to go around. And of course, everyone the majority of people are going to feel like, well, I have to grab what I can. I have to defend myself how I can, because it's going to be a blood fest, or movies like Purge and things like this. But we have to really keep in mind that unless, if you really do care about your country, you really do care about civilization, the culture, like the everything good that came out of the history of the United States and what it represented actually as an in opposition to empire. If you get sucked into these kinds of game theory scenarios where people are going to be pit one group against another group versus and another group and so on, it'll be endless. It's made for it to get extremely violent. You're going to be burning everything down. You're not going to be saving the good. It's going to be a real shit show. And, you know, we're doing the hard work of the game masters. We're going to just eliminate ourselves. We're going to do the culling ultimately in like the most horrible way. And then that will be justification, by the way, for the program that they want to set in, because everyone's going to be so ashamed of how terribly violent it got. Or if you're not ashamed, it's still going to be that there needs to be a police state put in place because it got so insane. So that's the sort of setup that I believe is happening. You have Eric Weinstein too, who, if people aren't aware of this, Johnny Vedmore was able to find an old paper. I don't know if it's like over 10 years old, I think, that he wrote.
Yeah, from like 2002 or so.
Yeah, where he wrote for the working for the United Nations about this whole immigration policy of, you know, to dilute culture. And it was done purposefully as a weapon. He even acknowledges this in his paper, that it's not going to go over well. So people have to realize, like, I'm not denying that there isn't a very serious problem. But if you think that, you know, the reaction to this is I need to defend my home, I need to defend my people by exacting violence, you are not going to come out of the scenario well. Your family is not going to come out of that scenario well. Like, it's not in your best interest, actually. And we have to really take a moment to see who is the game master. Look up from the game. And instead of, you know, everyone just reacting to the walls closing in, look up and see who's controlling the lever. Maybe we should deal with that guy, you know, that's controlling the lever. I think Martin Luther King was like spot on. That's why they killed Martin Luther King, because he said it's not a black race issue. It's not a white race issue. They're all in the same boat. As a white person, if you don't have enough food to put on the table to feed your children, you're just as badly off as the black people. So you should, he was saying, you white people in that situation, you should be on the streets walking with us to demand basic civil liberties, because you also don't have basic civil liberties right now. So yeah, that's like my rant on game theory before we get into any kind of history. Matt, I know that you have some images. I guess you have like the Pan Europe.
They do, yeah, yeah. Because yeah, this is going to be a big. You open up your book with a whole exposition on a figure that very few Westerners are aware of Count Richard Coudenhove Kalergi. And you also republished that chapter in a series on your Substack called A Modern Day Crusade for the Holy Land, part 1, 2, and 3, which is brilliantly written. I think you even added a few additional things. Part 2 is on a reformed anti-Semitism, fascism for Europe, fascism for Zionism. It's a great series. Again, it's part of the book. But Count Richard Coudenhove Kalergi is somebody who is so bloody important, not just for the creation of what becomes the European Union, but lays out a blueprint that I think has been put into operation and has been followed pretty closely for the past century. And yeah, I got that picture here. Here, I'll just play it. I'll put it on the, or here, that, there it is.
Yeah.
That's the flag.
So Yeah, he wrote several autobiographies, and he's quite honest, I find, and explicit as to his intentions.
Can I show a picture of him?
Sure. Yeah.
That's a painting of him with.
I've never actually seen that painting. Yeah. Well, yeah. That tells you that there's a lot of Freemasonry symbolism there.
Oh yeah, clearly high level Freemasonic obsessed, yeah, initiate for sure. And there's a book that he published on Pan Europa and or Europe Unite, and his special flag.
Yeah, so that flag was supposed to be so he's the one who is the father of Pan-Europeanism, which would eventually become the European Union. And his idea for the Pan-European flag was the Apollo sun and the Crusader cross. And he's very explicit in his autobiography that is what he wanted here. I'm just going to quickly find where is the... Oh, and I think I just erased it. Oh well. Yeah,
I got it if you want.
Yeah, I got it actually. Okay. So he wrote, "I chose the sign of the Red Cross superimposed on a golden sun as the emblem of our movement. The Red Cross, which had been the flag of the medieval crusaders, seemed the oldest known symbol of supranational European brotherhood. In more recent times, it has also gained recognition as a symbol of international relief work. The sun was chosen to represent the achievements of European culture in helping to illuminate the world, thus Hellenism and Christianity. The cross of Christ and the son of Apollo figured side by side as the twin enduring pillars of European civilization." It's going to be too much to go over in this discussion, the relevance of Apollo, but just to say that Apollo is very relevant in the Cult of Delphi. And if you've seen the movie 300, King Leonidas has to like pay tribute before he goes to war, right? Like the Cult of Delphi was basically anyone, and it wasn't just Greeks, but mostly Greeks, you would have to go to this cult and you would have to tell them your battle plans and everything in order to have like a sort of acceptance. Like the gods had to like, you know, bestow their favor on you. And there's often prophecy involved, you know, in this this Cult of Delphi, the promise of prophecy. But you see it in the 300 movie, which is actually quite historically accurate. Leonidas has to actually pay these people who are like very corrupt priests who are clearly intoxicating this young girl who's babbling nonsense. And all to say is that's quite a lot of power that all of these people have to come to you to share their military plans. You know, it's basically an intelligence center. So the Cult of Apollo, but there's also a lot of weird stuff as well with the Cult of Apollo.
Apollo also becomes the prototype for, he's a solar deity, right? And he becomes the prototype for Lucifer and later on as well. Yeah. Just as a side note, not to really belabor that, but just to say it's...
And the Templars are connected to this and there's a lot of Freemasonic connection to this, but it's a big one to talk about, which we're not going to really have enough time. Mm-hmm. But Kalergi is very explicit that his formation of the Pan-European Union is, here's another quote. First of all, he highlights that his Kuttenhofer line reaches back to the 11th century, and that they were part of the First Crusade. He's very proud of this. And they would, you know, become counts in the 18th century. He says, after the fall of the Roman Empire, the Crusades represented the most vigorous display of European solidarity. And he says, this league, and I'm going to explain it in a moment, but he's talking about a League of Nations that needs to also be formed in the in reaction to the First World War. But he says this league will have two objectives. First, to ensure permanent peace within the Christian world, and secondly, to rally the armed strength of Europe for the reconquest of the Holy Land and the Mediterranean. So he's very explicit that his idea of pan-Europe, which became the European Union, was to have the Holy Land conquest as one of the big issues. Now, the League of Nations is actually what is responsible for the Balfour Declaration, which created eventually the State of Israel. And really quickly, I'll explain what the League of Nations is first, and then I'll address why what actually was fascists behind. If you look at like the names in the Balfour Declaration, besides Rothschild, they're all like very clearly anti-Semitic people. So you would wonder like, why are a bunch of anti-Semitics who would later on become like very overtly pro-Nazi and pro-Mussolini, why were they the ones who created, you know, what would become Israel? But the League of Nations was basically, so after the First World War, you had the Treaty of Versailles, which was a form of economic warfare that also was like, basically gave Hitler what he needed in order to form the kind of extremism and desperation that would become the Nazi Germany. Kalergi acknowledges this in his autobiography. But after the First World War, there was also this talk of like, well, we need a League of Nations, and they were kind of selling it as like democratic republics, but it was obviously not. It was basically about six empires. It was going to be the a kind of Habsburg Empire, a British Empire, an American Empire, which would be all of North and South America. You'd have a Russian Empire, Chinese, Japanese, Arabia, and Africa were going to be satrapies in this. They were not considered, you know, to have any kind of civilization of their own. And Britain very clearly is brought up by Kalergi and also Churchill that Britain will be an exception to all these other empires, where they have a piece of Britain in each one of these empires. And so they're like the top empire. There is a hierarchy of empires in this vision. So what I see like playing out is very much a repetition of what they were trying to push in the early 20th century. And people have to realize that when we're talking about returning back to Roman, you know, ideologies or Roman principles, for me, this is sort of a trap to accept empire, and especially a world empire. But people have to understand that you as an average person are going to forfeit your rights in a system like that. That's not a system that's going to you know, protect the rights that you see today are coming under attack. Because there's a reason why these things are happening, because they want to actually attack the sovereign nation state construct. So the League of Nations was like a form of sophistry that they were using, saying like, oh, well, don't you want a United States of Europe? That's how Kalergi was selling it, which is absurd, because like the United States started out as 13 colonies who then started to communicate, form a common currency, you know, a banking system, forms of trade that allowed them to become a nation state. And we really take this for granted. Italy only became a sovereign nation state in the late 1800s. And even then it was like, it was not like how the Americans were able to form this in such a short amount of time. Germany was also only a sovereign nation state by the end of the 1800s. Like these countries were mostly provinces that were constantly warring with each other for centuries and did not actually have a common identity as a people that were united with an economic system and a political system and a civilizational system that was working together. And that was actually something that was considered a threat to empire. The United States was the one that created this great, you know, pushback with the American system of economics. So like Friedrich List in Germany, for instance, was directly putting in place American system economics, which is what was giving Germany its economic sovereignty. And that's why Germany was such a powerhouse in the 20th century, was because of direct adoption of the American system economics. You know, like Tsar Alexander II was it's very public that he actually, you know, Britain and France were saying that they were thinking of intervening during the Civil War. And Tsar Alexander II said, if you do this, I will consider it a casus belli, because he wanted the United States to stay whole. He did not want it to be divided because he knew it would be weaker. And he knew, he said this in an interview with Wharton Barker, that this, it wasn't because of any particular love of the United States, but recognition of what it represented as a system of economics that was opposed to the British imperialism that was like looting other countries, you know, like destroying the Indian textiles and having a monopoly on cotton at the time. Yeah. Is one of those points.
The whole idea that the European countries could just like reset their identities and all of a sudden just homogenize into some super state, some idealized United States of Europe, as Clergy and Churchill called it. It's so naive and stupid, because like you said, there's just so many different cultural differences, so much baggage. There's so many different types of economies.
Huh? It was the reverse, right? So It's like, you are sovereign nation states. You just earned that right, by the way. Like, it was like 2 seconds ago. And now they're trying to say, no, you should like form a European Union. And it's like, and we know now none of the European countries have control over what their military does, what their political choices are, or what their economic choices are. They forfeited all of those things into that blob. They were trying to get the United States to also join this. And there was a refusal from this. Kalergi was trying to get Roosevelt to join it, and he couldn't. But unfortunately, Roosevelt died 2 weeks before the first United Nations conference. And that's when John Foster Dulles like totally took it over and rammed through some really bad you know, articles like Article 52 in the United Nations, which allowed a facilitation of this like regionalism that Kalergi was trying to promote. So that's what they're trying to do right now, is they're trying to actually remove the sovereignty of nation states. And that's why I think there's this like false romanticism of like, where's our Rome? Like, I hear referenced a lot. Where's our Roman principles? Where's our Roman legacy or whatever, right? But it's to nudge you towards accepting a king. People should remember the story, right, of Junius Brutus when the Roman Republic first started, right? So it went through a phase of kings first, which were elected. It was still never it was never like a hereditary kingship of Rome. But when the last king was like basically rejected by the people because he was such a terrible tyrant, Junius Brutus said, never again will we suffer a king over us. So like, obviously Americans can identify with that a lot, but that's what Shakespeare brings up, is the tragedy in his Julius Caesar play, because the people had forgotten that they were free people. That, you know, if you want to be a free people, if you want to have like the biggest liberty, you know, like to have the most freedom of all, it also comes with responsibility. And by the time that Caesar came, there had been so much corruption within the Roman culture, and Shakespeare talks about this, that they had forgotten themselves, and they were like, Caesar, you be king. And it was a clear indication that the people had lost the right to self-govern, and they wanted to serve. And then when Caesar was killed, the irony, again, from Shakespeare's play, is that Brutus comes out, you know, with the other assassins. They come out with their bloody hands and they're like, we did this. And then they're trying to explain to the people how it's like, we freed you, just like my ancestor Junius Brutus. We're a free people now. And the people are calling for Brutus to be king. And then they make the mistake of allowing Mark Anthony to speak after, and then Mark Anthony is speaking, and then the people then start to call Mark Anthony for king. So it's again an indication that the people had really lost their way. And you can't have a free people if the people don't themselves have a concept of responsibility in that construct.
Right. Yeah, because you can only have a free society if every individual, like the idea of democracy can only even start working when you have a culture that encourages individuals who make up that democracy to take responsibility for their society as a whole. And if you don't have that, and instead, if you have a society of consumers, and democracy cannot happen. It just can't work. You need to have some form of top down order imposed onto people from above for that to work. In the course of your analysis of Kalergi's thinking and strategy, you make a point that he put a lot of emphasis on the idea of the Crusades as being such a great period in human history that created a certain type of identity that was wonderful. And you say, like, what is it that he saw in the Crusades? That was like, in my mind, I'm looking at the Crusades, I'm thinking that's just centuries of bloodbath of forever wars between Christianity and Islam. I don't see how anybody could see that as a good thing, but he does. So what's his thinking on that?
Are we going to start talking about the Freemasonic occult aspect of the Temple of Solomon? A more simple answer is, you know, Kalergi himself, so his father wrote a book on, I forgot now the full title, but it's like on anti-Semitism. And so the story is that his father started this book thinking he was going to have a justification for anti-Semitism. But then as he's doing his work on this, he becomes a Zionist. So his father is the one.
You mean he was going to do a book about anti-Semitism?
Yeah.
Or he was going to? Oh.
Yes. Yeah. And then he becomes a Zionist in his research on the justifications for anti-Semitism. He's still like anti-Semitic.
You're saying he was going to do a book in defense of anti-Semitism. Right. Was the first book he was.
Yeah.
Okay, that's different. Okay, great.
And in his research, he realized that Zionism was the best thing for anti-Semites, which is, again, explains a lot for why the Balfour Declaration was signed by, I think Rothschild was also probably an anti-Semite, because if you look at how Richard Kalergi, the Kalergi we've been talking about so far is Richard. His father starts to differentiate between reformed Jewry and unreformed Jewry. And he's basically saying that there's the Western types who have assimilated and those are fine, but the Eastern types have not assimilated. And, anti-Semitism won't be so bad if they just can go somewhere else. And so that was the justification for them
That's also how what's his name? Father of Zionism,
Herzl.
Thank you. That's how Herzl, in his personal diary, he pitched it to the Rothschilds, because he went and met with a bunch of Rothschilds, and I was reading through their like what his diary entry after he would meet with each of them. Some of them didn't care. Some of them were like, "Yeah, like I don't really care about any of this." But the ones who like they were able to get invested. That was the pitch. The pitch was, because they said, they were like, well, look at my life here. Like, I'm the big fish in London. Like, I'm not going to come rough it with y'all in the wilderness of Palestine. Like, I don't care about any of that. And he was like, yeah, but if we don't send them somewhere else, they're going to come here. And if they come here, they're going to bring their boorish, animalistic ways with them, these unrefined, people from the ghettos of Eastern Europe, and they're going to foment anti-Semitism. And then all of us are going to get thrown out of Western Europe. And that's how, like, that's how Theodore Herzl explains it. Who knows if that's what actually happened, but that's how Theodore Herzl explains getting the Rothschilds on board with the Balfour Declaration.
Yeah, and Herzl was talking to Joseph Chamberlain as well. Like, he talked to a lot of, like, people who basically identified with fascism. Like, there was actually not a clash in their view. And also, a really important point for people to realize is that, you know, this talk of sending the Jews to the Holy Land, obviously, there wasn't going to be enough space. Kalergi says this because he does an addendum to his father's book. And he says, you know, there's like about 6 million Eastern Jews that are not reformed and we need to expel them. The Holy Land doesn't have enough space for them. How about Angola and in Africa? And Joseph Chamberlain, when he was talking to Herzl, he was also talking about the Uganda scheme, which is weird because it's apparently in Kenya, but they call it the Uganda scheme. But again, to send Jews to Africa. And people should realize, like, when, you know, he's talking about the League of Nations, Africa and Arabia do not make the list. So these are like satrapies. So the Jews are very much kind of like, these Eastern European Jews are kind of viewed very similarly, it seems, to just Africans. And, you know, there was a plan for the apartheid as well. Kalergi was talking to big players in the apartheid of South Africa. And this was clearly going to be a much bigger plan for Africa. And so, again, very telling that they want to send the Jews to these areas. Kalergi also acknowledges that sending the Jews to Jerusalem with a bunch of Arab people living there is obviously not going to go well, and it's going to be violent. And so how I view this whole construct is that it was a setup, and they wanted these two groupings to kill each other off. So there's that aspect of things. I don't know if you guys want to say some things. I'd be interested to know also, Gordon, what you're looking at right now with like present day subjects, although you probably talked about it on your other show. So I don't know.
I don't mind repeating things, but I wasn't talking about this specifically, but yes, the Uganda scheme was one that was proposed. The Angola one as well. Argentina, that was also proposed, which is interesting because there's a lot of things that I'm finding in my research. There was a guy I need to find who this guy is, because I have a 13 minute clip saved on my computer. I can go pull it up. We don't need to watch it now, but it's from like 1985 or something. And this guy talking about a book that he was writing. It was like a news segment, and they just cut to like 5 minutes of this guy speaking. And he had just published a book, and the thesis of his book was that the term Nazi did not come from National Socialism. The term Nazi came from National Zionism, and that basically there was an alliance between the occultists in Germany and the Zionists, and basically the people persecuting the Jews were the Jews, and the ones who were assigned to like actually go into like the Jewish neighborhoods and actually dragging the Jews out of their houses were other Jews, and it was the people they were targeting primarily.
George Soros.
Exactly. I mean, Soros is who came to mind. I was like, holy shit, like this guy's talking about Soros. And what the way he described it is he said that it was the Zionists basically persecuting the non-Zionist Jews, like the Jews who didn't agree with the Jews in Central Europe who didn't agree with Zionism, who were kind of like, yeah, no, like that's antithetical to what the Torah says. Like, we're not supposed to go establish a Jewish state until the Messiah arrives. Those were the ones they went after. And they're like, no. We are like, Jews are going to be Zionists now. Like, that's the message. And so, you know, I think about that. And actually what this guy said is he said, you know, they should erect a statue of Adolf Hitler in Israel because he's one of the great founding fathers of Israel. He was talking about the Havar transfer agreement. And then he actually said that in the research he did for the book, we should all read this book. I need to figure out what book this is. He actually figured out that there was a debate in Israel to erect a statue of Adolf Hitler for like a minute, because they were like, You're like, you know, like we do owe a lot to Adolf. Like he did facilitate this massive transfer agreement of 6 million Jews, which is an interesting number.
Was it 6 million? I thought it was a smaller number. That many?
I think it was 6 million total. Like we're moved from over the course of the 30s into the 40s, we're moved from from Europe to Palestine. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that kind of raises the questions like, okay, well, like a lot of these people they say were killed in these camps, like were they just transferred to Palestine? Like, is that actually what happened?
That was the big Jewish problem or the Jewish question that Eichmann was so obsessed with, that he taught himself Hebrew. Adolf Eichmann taught himself Hebrew so that he could practice Kabbalah, the Jewish mystical tradition, because he was so enchanted and obsessed with this notion of Zion, of getting all the Jews extracted out of Europe, out of Russia, just get them out from there. And now there's no more Jews in Europe. Great, great problem that you've just solved. And people just, they obsessed about very much the Schindler's List stuff, but they ignore like, well, what about the 20 years before that? And all of the planning that was going into a very different strategy. We don't even get that question anymore, eh?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and so the really interesting part is that, to answer your question, Cynthia, the really interesting part is that when I learned about the Argentina colony, like that was really interesting. So a guy, I forget his name, went down to Argentina like in the 1890s, I think, and he established a Jewish colony there. And they actually had like a Jewish breakaway colony in Argentina. And at these World Zionist Congresses in the early 1900s, like 1901, 1902, these are the ones that Herzl went to. Herzl, I believe, dies of a heart attack in 1903. So it must have been like 1901, 1902, 1903. They're debating about using this colony. They're like, all right, well, the colony already exists. This guy already has like Jews living down there. Why don't we all just go to Argentina and we can all just go live in Argentina? And before I get to this next part, it's a side note. Interesting that one of the like places that all of the Nazis escaped to through their rat holes is Argentina. Like now there's huge Bavarian, German populations in Argentina, where you have like massive, like blonde hair, blue eyed, like populations of massive blonde hair, blue eyed Aryans who like fly the swastika, like in Argentina. Like that's weird. One of the key people, so the reason that doesn't happen, the reason they don't go to Argentina, the reason they don't go to Uganda, the reason they don't go to Angola, is because there's a contingency. There's a group of people who ardently fight everybody, and they're like, because Herzl's open to it. Herzl's like, I mean, he's you know what they call a secular Jew. He's like, I don't have any like ties to the Holy Land. I don't really care if we go there. But this group of people were like dead set. They were like, we will fight every single person in this room. We're going to Palestine. And one of the important people in that group is Nathan Malachowski. And Nathan Malachowski is Benjamin Netanyahu's grandfather. And he is one of the most important people who fought like tooth and nail to make sure that the Argentina proposal got shut down, that the Uganda scheme got shut down, the Angola and all the other ones that were being thrown out there. When I read that, I was like, wow, that is fascinating. Because he was like one of Herzl's friends. But when Herzl started to buy into it, he was like, absolutely not. There is no way we're going there. We're definitely going to Palestine.
It's fascinating. I got a question. Herzl was also writing letters to Cecil Rhodes, admiring letters about what Rhodes was able to accomplish in Rhodesia, Africa. Yeah. Rhodes was also the founder of what becomes the Rhodes-Milner Group, the Roundtable Group, the CFR, the Rhodes Scholar Networks that have played such a big role. Milner, Amory, both leaders of the Rhodes operation, right? And you were saying, Cynthia, that you brought up Milner as not just the author of the Balfour, or one of the crafters of the Balfour Accords, but also in your book, you make the point that he's also he describes himself, as Cecil Rhodes does, as a social imperialist. And you make a point that social imperialism actually has it's something that's been like scrubbed that it's kind of related, I guess, to Fabian socialism, but it's something else even. Can you say a little bit more about that idea that you make the point is actually at the heart of fascism and not nationalism, but social imperialism of the British Empire?
Oh, that's actually a really good point that I actually forgot about completely to bring up. That brings it back to what you were beginning the show with, which is what is the roots of fascism? Truly, is it because you're patriotic and you really believe in a strong nation state identity? And ultimately, it's always going to go fascist if you believe in that. So the idea is either two extremist ideas, which is to live in communes, which, by the way, was also being set up in the 1800s for a direction that was eventually for a one world government. And I know that's maybe a lot to take in. I'm actually working on a series on this, though. There were a lot of socialistic communes that were being promoted. Thomas Lake Harris from the Swedenborgian Church is one who worked closely with Lawrence Oliphant, who is a big British political player and also was in intelligence. And he was one of the first who actually went with his wife to Palestine and we're trying to get Jews to like come to Palestine. So there was a clear linkage there with the Thomas Lake Harris communes, which Lawrence Oliphant was a disciple of, and this thing that we've been talking about. But social imperialism with the roundtable, which Matt, you've done a lot more work on this and the Cecil Rhodes aspect of things, this existed. And so the term national socialism, which came from, now I'm forgetting his name. It's a French guy, but.
Oh, Sorel or something?
Sorel. Yeah. Good job. It really is at its true heart. It's social imperialism, and it came from, the schools like a Mackinder, viewpoint. I wish I had actually reviewed this a little bit more because it's a little bit hard for me to think about how to summarize it. Matt, do you?
No, it's fine. I just found the irony rich that it was actually like Fabian socialism and like social imperialism that was a top down creator and incubator of what becomes fascism. And fascism in that sense is actually more of a perversion of nationalism. By design, it's not like something that grew bottom up, and the fact that it ties into Herzl, it ties into Milner, Cecil Rhodes, this whole network that's working with Kalergi, as well as the like U.S. deep state operation, like people like Walter Lippmann and Alan Dulles, who are tied very closely to the CFR, and they both come up in your book too. These like Fabian socialists in America working through the CFR that are bringing in Kalergi. Can you go through like how Kalergi's interfacing with this deep state operation in America?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I want to maybe focus again on the social imperialism aspect because I think it is important for us to flesh that out because that is what people are very much getting attacked with in terms of a concept. And it's actually, I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can say a thing about like the way in reading your book, the thing that caught my eye is that it became more, it was like a discovery almost that it's more effective to control your target audience by giving them the illusion that like by having the state sort of take control of their like of the things that normally a citizen would be responsible for, right? And all of a sudden they don't have to because the state is going to now come in and do things for you. You don't have to participate as a citizen. You know, you all of a sudden you're more of a subject, and you're getting like your ass wiped by the state. And increasingly, you're losing connection to your ability to just be a human being and to be moral. And that's the sort of type of people that this oligarchy adores. So the fact that it would come out of the mind of, you know, of these creatures, that's super super important. And you know, I was thinking about Walter Lippmann and the CFR crowd of the Roundtable Movement in America, and how they were all, again, promoting this idea of turning America into a sort of Fabian socialist type of like technocracy in some sense. So okay. That's yeah. Go ahead.
I have something now to say about it. Sorry. Yeah. I do research on so many different things, and I have not reviewed this recently, so it's a lot to keep in my mind. But yeah, so the Fabian society construct is the brand of social imperialism, like you're talking about. Oswald Mosley as well was like very closely tied with the Fabian society, and also this brand of Marxism.
And Oswald Mosley, this guy's the head of, well, who's Oswald Mosley? Just because people might not know who that is.
Well, he's the leader of the Black Shirts in Britain, which was basically, it was either going to be him or Lloyd George, who was a prime minister who's very openly pro-Nazi, who were going to be the two candidates for prime minister under a Nazi Britain, which there were a lot of people who were in support of this, including Churchill. But yeah, so social imperialism, I realize it is not an easy thing to actually define so clearly, so I don't feel so bad, but I'm reviewing some of my notes here. And yeah, the Fabian Society is a major player of this. Oswald Mosley is definitely was promoting the social imperialism concept. And Mackinder also comes out of the Fabian London School of Economics and this idea of the heartland, world island idea. Bertrand Russell, H.G. Wells, George Bernard Shaw, these were all people who were working towards an idea of social imperialism. And it was a Fabian liberal strategy for national efficiency. You can see the Boer War actually was another kind of lab experiment. Mm. The apartheid Boer War is actually extremely important for like just the Vietnam War also was a big lab experiment. They were trying out some of these things that they're going to, that they ultimately want to launch on a much broader fashion. So I'm just reading my notes here. Social imperialism was basically an idea vaguely of a government that engages in imperialism as a means to preserve social peace. So they could use the socialist way of thinking for social reform, but in service to imperialistic goals. And that's actually something I wanted to share with you guys with Churchill, because there is this... Oh, now that I've like moved my page, it's different. But Churchill was basically working with Kalergi for this concept of a one world government, which would have also a global police construct to it as well, which now I can't find the quote on my page because I moved things around too much. But yeah, even though that was a little bit sloppy, I hope that I got a bit of the idea across.
Oh yes, no, that was great. That was great. I have a few things to add. This is like what of what you just said, and I'm kind of spitballing here. But all right, so you just mentioned this guy, who I'm not familiar with, but Sir Oswald Mosley, and it says right here, he founded the British Union of Fascists in 1932. Mm-hmm. Led to its forced dismemberment in 1940. He stood against Neville Chamberlain in 1924. And you know, he sought alliances with Benito Mussolini and Adolf Hitler. Like, all this stuff is tracking. This is what caught my eye, though, is I'm like trying to read, like just scanning to his personal life. This guy marries the daughter of Lord Kuskun. Or Lord Curzon.
He's like the viceroy to India or something.
Yeah. Yo, is that Swastika? Is that the daughter Swastika?
The daughter is Lady Cynthia Simi.
Oh, okay.
Curzon. No, Matt, that's for Oswald Mosley married a second time, because his daughter ends up dying, and he married another woman from the Guinness family, and her sister was called Swastika, and she actually was one of Hitler's mistresses. And when Hitler was supposedly killed at the end of the war, she shot herself in the head, but she didn't succeed, and she was like mentally retarded for the rest of her life. According to
and then this guy married her.
Mosley married his sister.
They were related to
Churchill's wife as well. According to MI5 records, they were saying that this girl named Swastika was more Nazi than the Nazis.
Jeez. Yeah. But I mean, Curzon is like, this guy is pretty important and carving up the world, right? He's the one, as I understand it, and I'm just recalling things off the top of my head, but he's the one who is like placing a lot of people in key positions, if I'm not mistaken. And the people who he's placing in key positions are the ones who ultimately carve up the Middle East and ultimately, basically during World War I, create the conditions to make the world under the rule of London, of like the city of London, despite the fact that imperialism formally kind of goes away after World War I, right?
Yeah, it's setting up the Sykes-Picot thing. I know that there was like a war between the British India Bureau and I think the British Arab Bureau. But ultimately, you know, for a similar vision, but you know, they're kind of competing with each other, I think, for certain types of influence. I think T.E. Lawrence was with the Arab Bureau. I think Oswald Mosley was also with the Arab Bureau. Because he does seem to have a very strained relationship with this person, and he really mistreats the daughter. Like, he doesn't seem to show ultimately that much respect, oddly. I was confused actually about that. Maybe that's not the full story, but definitely he was brought in. Oswald Mosley was brought in. I think it's Martin Sykes. He worked for him with the Arab Bureau for the League of Nations thing as well. But yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. So you mentioned like him, like the fight between the India office and the Arab office. So like, yeah, it says right here in 1905, he presided over the partition of Bengal and came into conflict with Lord Kitchener over issues of military organization. Unable to secure the backing of the government in London, he resigned later that year and returned to England. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting about that, so this guy's is fighting with Lord Kitchener. I don't know why my mouse is doing that. Kitchener is the guy who as I understand it, from my like general reading of it, I haven't done the deep dive on this guy, but my understanding of it is that he was not necessarily backing like they had different agents out in the field. Like they had that guy, Jack Philby, who was in bed with the Saudis. They had, they eventually put T.E. Lawrence in with the Hashemites. Kitchener, I think, is the guy, if I'm not mistaken, who was going to go warn the Russians about like the Russian Revolution. And then he's on the boat.
So they blew up his ship.
Yeah, he's on the boat in 1916 going to Russia to go warn the Russians that, hey, these people are going to kill y'all if y'all don't watch out. And then the ship blows up on the way to Russia, right? It says right here he dies June 5th, 1916.
Yeah, he's an odd one, right? Because he was also in charge of the Boer War, the Second Boer War.
Yeah.
And it seemed like he was partially working. He wasn't being very successful because he wasn't, it seems, he didn't have the stomach to take the war properly to the kids and the women. And Lord Milner at that time takes the reins and says, no, we have to use different techniques. The guerrilla fighters are just not beatable. You know, you had a bit of a collaboration between the Dutch and the Zulus. And the only way we can beat them is by creating concentration camps. That was the first use of concentration camps as they were known in the 20th century. And start filling and starving and poisoning the water systems and taking the war to their families. And something like 25,000 white children, probably a much larger number of black children, black families, were killed by the Milner technique. And from what I gathered from a lecture that I heard, Lord Kitchener was not on the same page, although he did still welcome the accolades he got by putting down the rebellions. But again, it brings you right back into this Milner Rhodes nest everywhere you look.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it says right here he was initiated into Freemasonry in 1883. And this is another anecdote about him that I recall is that he was the one they commissioned in 1874 to go. Remember, Matt, one of the first episodes we did together was the Palestine Exploration Fund. This is the guy they commissioned to go to Palestine to map it all out for them and draw grids, create the grid line system. They still, as I understand it, they still use that grid line system today in Israel.
He was brought in that early. Okay. Yeah. So he was brought right in with Sir Charles Warren and Annie Besant's brother, Walter Besant and King Edward VII. That's a big deal. That placed him right in that Solomon Temple cult revivalist movement of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. Because all of these guys, that's why they called themselves the Round Table, right? They wanted to reconstruct this ideal of the Grail Knights of Arthur's Round Table that was basically tied directly to the Templars as sort of a Templar recruitment tool. And all of that's why Cecil Rhodes called it that. That's why Leo Amery was obsessed with recreating the Temple of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. They were all like trying to do what Kudenhava Kalergi was doing. And Cynthia, I just find this fascinating because I've spoken to people who are academics and they've told me, oh no, that's a slander. Kudenhava Kalergi was not a fascist. He was a pacifist. But then, you know, if you look at some of the membership, like I got a little image that you use in your book, like
all you have to do is read Kalergi's autobiography. He's like so clearly pro Mussolini. He says so himself that he is for a Mussolini brand of fascism.
Yeah, like the networks, you got Karl Haushofer who's like supporting him. You got Max Warburg, you got Hitler's banker, Hjalmar Schacht right there in the middle. The Mussolini networks are all around. So I mean, why do people
Oh sorry. No, you finished your question.
No, I was gonna just say, like, how would you just refute that, like, really thoroughly, like, just blow it up? This whole argument that he's a pacifist and.
Well, I mean, he literally talks about how he's for these things in his autobiography. So I'm a little bit perplexed as to why people would make these claims, because he writes in his own words that he's for these things, and even for like. Mein Kampf, there's a few groupings because, you know, there's like the Austrian socialists that are also involved in this that are also fascist, but there was a fight between Hitler and Mussolini as to who would ultimately, you know, which Austria would side with which one of those. But he's talking about how these two groupings that Hitler himself was crediting for his views were Kalergi was working with the leaders of those groupings in Austria as well, and Mussolini directly. He's only very careful at trying to deny that he had anything to do with any of the members of the German Nazi Party once they announced, you know, once Hitler came into power, which even of itself does not seem to be true. And I go through some of the details in that. But suffice to say, he still talks about those people in positive terms, even though he denies that he met with them after Nazi Germany commenced. He's still writing about their ideas, like very influential Nazi players. So, I mean, another interesting point that I think is useful to bring up about Kalergi is that it was Pope Pius, I think, what is the 11th?
I was thinking that, yeah.
Who was a Pope at the time. By the way, it's very interesting, Mussolini's role with like freeing the Vatican, because, you know, the Vatican was kind of like put in a sort of constraint in the late 1800s, because, you know, the Vatican used to back in the day have its own army. Like it was going to war with other Italian provinces. It was not like this amicable, peaceful type thing always. And there were a lot of really bad popes. There were good popes too, but there were a lot of bad popes. And, you know, having a papal army is obviously that's always promoting crusades is obviously going to get people to be upset at a certain point. And so to the credit of the Italians, even though, you know, you have like the French Revolution, then you have like what's similar in Italy, there's also a bit of a revolution happening there where the people are trying to become independent. They're trying to form the sovereign nation state. They're trying to rid themselves of the yoke of empire and hereditary monarchy, which is just like one dumbass after another dumbass kind of thing. So Mazzini actually comes in to Italy during this very important time. And Mazzini ends up showing his true colors because when he does get power, he basically calls himself, you know, like almost an emperor. Yeah, he's a dictator of Rome. So it was very clear what he was working for always. There's actually connections with him and British orchestrations as well, which is too much for us to go through today. But Kalergi even says in his autobiography that Mazzini, who started the Young Europe movements, and there was a Young America movement. This is also involved with the Scottish Rite, Albert Pike type activities in the United States. Kalergi acknowledges in his autobiography that Mazzini was the forerunner to fascism, and he has no issues with that. He talks about fascism in positive terms. Anyway, so Pope Pius XI is Pope, the first Pope under the Mussolini regime. But Kalergi, when he comes to Italy to meet with Mussolini, he doesn't meet with this Pope. He meets with Cardinal Pacelli, who will become Pope. Like, I don't know,
four years later
or more. And he was only meeting this guy every time he came to Italy, which clearly shows that he knew that he was on the ascendancy. And this is the notorious Pope that never, you know, really pushed back on the atrocities that were happening. He didn't even, I think, speak out against them. So there was this kind of involvement that Kalergi had, very close ties. Kalergi was clearly, he's from the Habsburg Empire legacy. So he views himself as an aristocrat, nobility from the Habsburgs. He's half Japanese and half, Austrian, I think. And, his father is a Jesuit as well. But his view is part of it is to revive a Habsburg Empire, but a much more glorious Habsburg Empire. And so the whole, you know, tying of the Anschluss, sorry, I can't say it very well, the uniting of Germany and Austria, but it would be with a huge section of Eastern Europe, basically, that would be a renewed Austro-Hungarian empire. And the Pope seems, this Pope, Pope Pius the 12th, seems to have been in on this game plan. And Kalergi even makes a point in his one of his autobiographies that Catholicism actually really suited fascism, whereas Protestantism suited democratic processes. If people want the direct quote, they can go to my Substack page and see my paper on it on the subject.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And you're on the issue of the Habsburg Empire. This is a picture here of Kudenhove Kalergi and Otto von Habsburg. That's an older version of Habsburg here on the upper right. A lot of people don't know that he was the mentor of Otto von Habsburg and that he gave the reins to Pan-Europa to Otto von Habsburg. So when the Habsburg Empire was dismantled after World War I, the Habsburg like royal bloodlines didn't go away. They always had their fantasies and obsession with recapturing their lost grandeur and crowns and regalia and pomp and all of that stuff. So this guy, you see a picture of this guy, Otto von Habsburg as a kid. And he's like, again, they got little crowns on him and stuff. And he's just, you could tell he's aching to go back to the grandeur, just like Kudenhove Kalergi, from a higher family, just so romantic about this stuff. Mm-hmm. But he ends up becoming the head of the Pan-Europa after Kalergi. Did he come up a lot in your research? And the whole idea of like bringing about a new sort of remixed Habsburg Empire emanating through the power of its control or influence within the Catholic Church, or especially these crusader, because we're seeing that these crusader networks are everywhere, right? Like the Reinhard Galen, the head of the SS, the heads of the SS are members of the Order of Malta, and a bunch of others around Himmler are members of the Order of Templars, and Alan Dulles is a member of the Order of Malta. And I think every CIA director was a member of the Order of Malta. They were all knights. And Kissinger is a knight of the Order of St. George and St. Michael, and so is George Bush. So you got these things just everywhere. So I was wondering, could you speak a little bit more about the influence of like this perversion, this version of the Catholic Church as far as being a useful instrument of advancing towards this strange, sick objective that Kudenhove, Kalergi and company are obsessed with?
You're asking such a loaded question. Like, I feel like we could spend an hour talking about that. But, you know, to be completely honest, when I was working on this book, I didn't actually understand the occult aspect of things the way I do now. So it was still like a stepping stone for me for where I am now. So I don't know that kind of detail connected with Kalergi. Obviously, there is that kind of connection there. And maybe I just missed it at the time because I didn't understand the occult at all when I was writing this book. And I was trying to just get like a very simple blueprint for where I could go from there. But I know, Matt, that you wanted to share some thoughts on a particular individual. Maybe we can talk about that and wrap it up, because poor Gordon has done many shows.
Go do it.
I see that, Gordon, you're looking at like, is that like some Templar procession that you're looking at?
Oh yeah. I don't know if y'all have seen this, but I have really good to share.
Share that, and I'll share the thing. So the thing that I noted is that so this guy Otto von Habsburg, so he didn't just create the Pan-European movement, but he himself created another organization called the Dignitas Humani Institute to sort of unite all of Christendom and all of Europe, but also the Christendom more broadly around a new crusade, pretty much. And the guy who was brought in to be the manager of Dignitas Humani Institute is here. Let me just show this, do a screen share here. StreamYard. Allow. Oh, there it is. Okay, good. Is this guy. So this is a Daily Mail article from 2024 November. That's titled, Steve Bannon now wants to open gladiator schools in the U.S. for aspiring right-wing politicians after his allies won legal battles in Italy to keep MAGA training ground in an 800-year-old monastery. I think they're abusing the word MAGA. I think that it's a very particular type of new revamped MAGA that there's an effort to try to create. Here's another article from ArtNet. About 9 months ago, saying Steve Bannon's right-wing gladiator school could go ahead following legal win in Italy. And this is the actual gladiator school right here. That's this 800-year-old monastery in Trastulli. That's the headquarters of the Dignitas Humani Institute. And that's the, his sort of right-hand man who is an executive at the Dignitas Humani Institute that Otto von Habsburg established, who's going to be at least a front man for it along with Bannon. And this guy himself is Benjamin Hart Harnwell, and he's a British conservative European Parliament aide. That's both of them there in Italy. The Trastulli Monastery is way behind them right there. And when you look at the Trastulli Monastery, it's really, really creepy, because this thing was built in, here's another picture of it. It's beautiful. I mean, really beautiful. There's Trastullian just a little area in Western Italy. And it was built by Pope Innocent III. And it says here, Bannon, a quote from him saying, "We have started an academy for the Judeo-Christian West. It's essentially a gladiator school for the modern information age political warfare. And we're going to do it in a monastery in Rome. It's kind of the headquarters, but do it throughout the United States and Western Europe and other places. Take people from Asia, take people from India, and train people how to win. This is a populist nationalist academy." But again, the choice of this particular monastery, Trastulli, is that it was built in 1204. And 1204 is an auspicious year. It was built in celebration for the Fourth Crusade. So the Fourth Crusade was the big crusade where Venice was basically able to trick a bunch of crusader knights run by the Templars and an Order of Malta to go and sack Constantinople, to loot Constantinople, another Christian kingdom, the seat of the Byzantine Empire, destroy it and then replace the Byzantine Empire as the most dominant empire in the world. That was Venice. And they use their control of their assets in the papacy to make this happen. Now, Bannon himself, on top of coming out for a network of gladiator schools. I don't think it's just for information warfare to teach politicians that they want to try to create, as because there is obviously a lot of there's a lot of people getting disgusted heavily by the woke dictatorial behavior of the technocracy in the UK and France, everywhere. So obviously there's, as you have that, you have more reactionary backlash to a conservative extreme, but who's going to control that conservative reaction and who's going to be able to nudge it? And this is where this is becoming more evident in my mind, is that you have the Otto von Habsburg network around Bannon, and he's being sponsored by this Maria Thronontaxis, another high up family in the Habsburg dynasty, who's a big sponsor, who's giving her properties to, or allowing Steve Bannon to use her properties to. And he said that when he talks about Judeo-Christian civilization, I don't think it's a very healthy idea of what that means. He says, "We, America, are going to war in the South China Sea in 5 to 10 years. There is no doubt about it." And then he says, "I want the world to look back 100 years and say their mercantilist Confucian system lost. Judeo-Christian liberal West won." It's this game theory winner-loser idea of the future. There's in the mind of in this type of mindset, there's no idea of a common humanity or win-win outcomes. It's all about defeating the other in a way that you outlined, Cynthia, in your opening remarks. And then he says again in 2014, he says, "We are in an outright war against jihadist Islamic fascism. And this war is, I think, metastasizing far quicker than governments can handle it. We are at the very beginning stages of a global conflict. And if we do not bind together as partners with others in other countries, that this conflict is only going to metastasize. We are now, I believe, at the beginning stages of a global war against Islamic fascism." So it may not be the same language used by Pope Innocent III back in the 1200s to get the Fourth Crusade, but the language is still very similar, and they're bringing in different gangs of Islamist Wahhabites and you know, rape gangs that are then used to destroy or disturb the peace in the nations that are taking them in. So you're seeing these horrific acts of like women, white women getting like dabbed on trains and horrific acts, clearly, but it's being done by design to paint in the minds of people in the West that is Islam. You're looking at Islam. Yeah. And we have to now think that, okay, maybe the Crusaders were right. Maybe we do need to exterminate this evil apostate force, you know, and this is the type of language that I'm just seeing emerge so much more around Nick Fuentes and others, but you're already seeing it in Bannon's language already over a decade ago.
I think we could also quickly make a note that Gladio is very much a crusader type construct. Right. And, you know, we've talked about this, all three of us on your show in the past, where Gladio was exposed, you know, by the late 1990s, with a huge declassification act where Gladio was the name for it in Italy. It had a different name in different countries throughout the world, but it was NATO's secret army. And, what they were caught doing, and when Italy is particularly bad, it was the years of lead, they called it, but it was about 20 years or more. Through the Christian Democratic Party was directly implicated in this in Italy, where they would create terrorist acts within the country, blame it on other groupings. And maybe those groupings were also duped into participating in it, but they were not the organizers of it. It's like what the FBI has done so many times with domestic terrorist acts in the United States. You can almost always find the FBI actually created the entire construct, and you might have some people who are not FBI members, but it would never have gone off, you know, it would never have been able to execute any kind of action without FBI funding and FBI organizing. Yeah. So Gladio had been doing all of these things to get blame it on other groupings to actually push people towards extreme right policies and government. So again, when these kinds of acts are happening, where, you know, the immigrants or the illegals or an extremist group is committing these acts against people, you have to also question where is this really organic or not? Because more often than not, you know, it's the same operation that's behind the scenes. And again, the blueprint hasn't changed. Like, that's the point, is that they failed with the World War II execution of their plan, but it went underground, but a lot of it also just, it remained in institutions, and it just didn't, you know, announce its intention. But if you look at what Tavistock was able to do, for instance, it was like a total takeover. And then Rand Corporation is another form of takeover, where they went into institutions everywhere, but it was on all levels of society, including education, including military. Tavistock is married with the British Army to create policies, which were then part of the lab experiment in Vietnam. So it's an amazing amount of work that they've been trying to do to get the dream going. So in on that side of things, that's really good news, because it shows how unnatural it is, and it shows how much people fight against it. And it's like, with all of this planning and all of this work, it's a bit absurd, you know, the level of obsession. But the threat is very real. I don't think any of us think that such a plan is sustainable, but it doesn't mean that it can't create a lot of havoc.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. What? Yeah, Gordon?
Yeah, well, like all the points you're making, this is all like controlled opposition dynamic. This is all controlled opposition, Hegelian dialectic, create the problem, present the solution. The solution is always an expansion of the security state, an expansion of the police state, the move towards totalitarianism. And, you know, fascism, I think, fits really nicely into that, you know, into that dynamic. I think the penultimate example of fascism, or maybe the better way to put it, is the ultimate form of fascism, the best example of fascism. People always talk about Nazi Germany, and maybe that's the case. I don't know. I think there's a lot of disinformation about that entire era in general, so it's hard to know what's real and what's accurate. But if you look at modern day Israel, I mean, that I think is the quintessential fascist state, because they always have had a socialist economy up until I learned 1987. They had a very strict economy where they didn't allow outside investment, where the Israeli government pretty much had to be intimately involved in like all the big corporations. And then, of course, the whole ethos, like, that Benjamin Netanyahu openly professes now, is the idea of the state over the individual. Like, no individual life is bigger than the collective, because if the collective fails, if the state fails, then the entire Jewish identity is threatened to be extinguished. Like that's the whole idea of intertwining the Jewish identity with the Zionist state of Israel. And so therefore when it comes to Israeli national security, everything is on the table. Nothing is beyond their means, including sacrificing the lives of their own citizens, like sacrificing hundreds of Israeli lives to perpetuate millions of Israeli lives and save them ultimately. That's totally justified.
Mm-hmm. It's wild. They have this whole means justify the ends logic that never works. Like we have to do evil because our ends are good. That always work, like turns into a bloodbath of a disaster that never, every like hardcore evil dictator that's ever lived did the evil that they did with that logic in mind. But my ends are just, I want world peace, so I have to create these wars, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think the place that I thought it made sense to maybe like wind down with this is, I don't know if y'all saw this is from the other day. And I don't even know if this is like true, but this is from an account called the Knights Templar International. It says it's the largest official non-Masonic Templar organization in the world, and true to the spirit of our Christian forebears, has 173,000 followers. And it says, we are so back after 700 years, the Knights Templar returned to the Vatican with their red crosses, relics, and banners. The Knights Templar have again been welcomed and recognized by the church this month at the Holy Door of St. Peter's Basilica in the Vatican. There is a rising alliance between traditionalist Catholic groups, neo-chivalric orders in the Vatican during a time of escalating global tension, cultural collapse, and calls for spiritual order. The message to the enemies of Christianity: we remember our warriors. To the faithful, the church may be flawed, but it is rallying and organizing. To the elites, you are not only power in this world, you are not the only power in this world. This is part of the broader rise of traditionalism, nationalism, and spiritual revival, both inside and outside the church. This is from 3 days ago. Are they saying that they had not been allowed at the Vatican for the past 700 years?
Well, they were so technically the Knights Templar. Look at the music and everything. Yeah, it's weird. They were originally taken down in 1307. They were, you know, the Jacques de Molay and a bunch of his buddies. He was the Grand Master at the time of the Templars, and they had control of world banking. People say, you know, it's all the Jews. It's like, no, it was the Templars. They did use Jews to do a lot of the dirty work of the banking and the financial warfare, but they ran the ports. They had the monopoly on the seas. They ran that was the dominant economic machinery, was the Templars. And they were practicing black magic, it seems. And there were a bunch of whistleblowers who came out. Their base was under Solomon's Temple and Solomon's Mines. They had a whole commitment to purgative violence as a way to redeem ourselves. We have to kill and be prepared to, you know, basically die and kill. It's part of the redemption of our sin. So they had this whole weird Gnostic view that we are all evil, like we're born evil, we're born as in sin. So just like God sacrificed his child, so too must we all sacrifice others, you know, in the sake of this purgative sacrifice of whatever the sacred sacrifice stuff. So that is a weird thing. They're worshiping, you know, they're doing some weird gay stuff too as part of their initiatory rites. And some people didn't like that, blew the whistle. And basically they got taken down, but they didn't disappear. And Cynthia, she's done a whole series on how the Templars reorganized and went underground and came up over in different iterations over the years. But this new Templar order, it's run by this dude, Jim Dawson. Oh, what's his name here? Computer's not working. It is from the BBC, but obviously they're going to do everything with a hyper left twinge. But this is the guy, Jim Dawson. The article is this Britain's most influential far right activist? He works, it seems, very closely with Tommy Robinson. He runs the Knights Templar International. It was sort of, anyway, it's a militant Christian group, but not really. And they've got like a really romantic utopian idea of what the Templars were. And Tommy Robinson, who he again seems to have been working with, he's been promoting a lot of this revivalism of crusader thinking. Tommy Robinson's been doing the same thing. And he's also a massive Zionist shill. Like, the guy himself has worked for Mossad, right? Like, Tommy Robinson is part of this Israeli intelligence thing. So again, you have this collusion, this obsession with the Middle East, reviving crusaders. It's Nazism. Something smells of Nazism. Because again, Heinrich Himmler also had a New Templar order, right? In Wevelsburg Castle. That's where they're carrying out human sacrifice and other things to do magical workings to get demon spirits to abide by what the Grand Master and his initiates around the round table. Himmler actually had an Arthurian round table in Wevelsburg Castle as part of his knighthood. So everyone's trying to like lay claim to being the New Templars. And I don't think there's just one thing, right? And Cynthia, I don't know about you. What would you say? How would you describe the manifestation of that old Templar power?
Oh my God.
It's not just like one thing. What?
You're asking such loaded questions, but maybe
you've done so much work on it. I
can't answer that in like a few sentences.
All right. So maybe we'll do a future show. We'll do a future show on it. I guess that's not a bad idea. Okay.
Wait, but one book that's really good on this is
Occult Roots of Nazism
with Nicholas Goodrick Clark. And I still haven't studied enough of that, so I definitely could not summarize it in like a minute, but there's a lot of what you said. But I think we should definitely reserve that for another time.
Okay. All right. Cool. Yeah. And I'm gonna include a bunch of links, not just to your book, but also to your article series on the Knights of Malta and the evolution of the Templars into the Grand Orient, into the Scottish Rite. It's an amazing series that you did, and I'm gonna include that in the description box as well, so people can dip into your research on this as a setup for the next show that we do on this in more detail. But we have also another sponsor before we round out today's show. So I'm just going to read that. One second. It is SLNT. Let me see what this is. SLNT Faraday. Introducing SLNT. Empower your right to disconnect with SLNT Faraday cage bags.
Oh.
In a world where tech never sleeps, our mission is to keep you safe, private, and healthy. Our patented technology shields your devices from hacking, tracking, and EMF radiation, giving you autonomy over your digital life. Disconnection sparks creativity, strengthens relationships, and brings peace of mind. With SLNT, you get effortless gear built with integrity, always staying one step ahead to protect your data and security. Choose SLNT and reclaim your freedom to disconnect. Visit badlandsmedia.tv/Faraday and use promo code Badlands to snag your 10% discount. That's badlandsmedia.tv/Faraday, promo code Badlands. All right. Sweet. So yeah, we went through quite a bit. I hope that people are salivating right now to want to like really take this exploration to the next level. And like I said, The Empire in Which the Black Sun Never Set, volume 1, volume 2 is in the works. When do you think volume 2 is going to be ready, Cynthia?
Unfortunately, I'm working on volume 2 for Shaping of a World Religion right now, but more of the occult aspect of this history I'm getting sucked into.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, do we want to say a quick maybe ending on positive things that people should be focusing on right now?
It's a great idea. Sure. Yes, go for it.
Okay. Well, I think that this idea of, strengthening the economic system within the country is an important point that people shouldn't lose sight on. Because I think Clergy also makes a real point on this, that's like really you need an economic breakdown in order to bring in the chaos. And I think there's a lot of distraction going on because we originally kind of we're talking more about economics as a form of solution and strengthening of the country. And I don't know how much that's like having as much playtime in discussion on television or on social media, but that's definitely something that people should be really focusing on, is returning to the proper schools of industry that had originally made the United States a great economy, one of the most prosperous places in the world. Like, think about the black and white movies where an average American was living in beautiful houses, and imagine like how other people in other places of the world, they were like, oh my God, like the average American has a palace of their own. That was the kind of legacy that the Americans were really bringing forward. And like I was saying, the Germans were adopting this, the Russians were, the Japanese with the Meiji Restoration. Even Sun Yat-sen was talking about American economics. He studied in Hawaii and had American patriots that were schooling him. So we need to really revisit these aspects of strength and not get distracted and divided in these kinds of false situations of artificial crisis, right? Artificial scarcity, artificial pressure cookers, because it's not actually real. This isn't like an inevitability where we're constantly having to clash with each other until there's one ruling group. That's a falsehood. Zero-sum game, it's not real. It's part of game theory. You're a sucker if you believe in it. We need to return back to the principles of the true American system, which was also teaching those principles to other countries like the Centennial Exhibition, because they realize that for others to prosper is a benefit for your country to prosper as well.
Yeah, it's the best remedy for like game theory, zero sum thinking, where there's just, you're basically a rat living in a cage that's shrinking and shrinking and diminishing returns. And you just have to fight other rats no matter for eternity in the eternal war. And if you actually shift gears and think of yourself in a more dignified manner, and then realize that you could think about that other people are just like you, though they might have a different religion, a different culture, they're human beings first and made in the image of a living creator that has these attributes of being aware of our mortality and wanting to make something better for our kids. And then when that is the attitude, then we problem solve as our species character, and we work together to problem solve big objective problems like hunger, war, things that nobody wants, right? Only oligarchs, sociopathic oligarchs, want those things. And then we build economic systems that create more hope, like what Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat were doing. And that beautiful, beautiful video you made, Gordon, is just, I've been sharing that around a lot. It's really great. Just the way of thinking of Yitzhak, who was able to overcome all of his problems and bigotry and all of the problems, and just shift gears and change his axioms, along with Arafat, around this idea that we could develop an economy together for our children and start the healing process. It's never too late until you basically blow up the world under a Samson doctrine, of course. But I mean, it's never too late to get back to a healthy human modality. And you look at, people think that they have this false choice of either you're an isolationist, either you find your nationalism around isolationism and just like lock down and don't think about the world, otherwise you're my enemy, or you're an internationalist, in which case you have to get rid of nation states. And it's like, wait a minute. No, that's a false choice. That's a totally false choice. We can think of ourselves as proud nationalists, but living in a community of other proud nations wanting to work together to make the world a better place. What a revolutionary idea that is. And that doesn't come up at all in Kudinova Klergi, Habsburg ideology. It's all about divide to conquer. Actually, I got to show you guys this thing. Otto von Habsburg's kid, Karl von Habsburg, is a member of parliament in Austria. And he's the current head also of the Pan-Europa movement. And he works closely, again, just like his dad did, with all of these CFR think tanks, pushing ideas like Lord Curzon was doing with the partitioning of Bengal. And here's a video of him talking about breaking up Russia that just happened like a few months ago. This is Karl von Habsburg. Let me know if you can hear it.
Can't hear it. Make sure it sounds similar. No, can't hear it. Try resharing it.
Okay, I'm on it. I'm on it. I'm on it. Okay, I really want people to see this. So add to stage. Oh, I see. I have to just completely stop it and then reshare. So stop screen. And now I'm going to reshare it.
And make sure you check the little thing at the bottom that says.
Oh, it says mute website.
Share sound or whatever.
Yeah, it doesn't even show up as an option, unfortunately. So no, I can't do it.
Put it in the chat. Put it in the private chat, yeah. and I'll share it. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I'm gonna do that because it's so wickedly interesting. Based on everything that we just heard today. Where's the private chat? Oh, here it is. Comments. No, that's not it. Where's the private chat? Oh, there it is. Private chat. Here it is. Okay, sent it to you. Yeah, it was weird that it wasn't giving me that ability. So this is again.
The small conference of the post-war Russia forum took place in Vienna, in which the pan-European movement also participated. A participant from Ukraine said, "Big Russia brings big problems, small Russia causes small problems." To be precise, he was talking about the Moscow colonial empire. Today's Russia is actually a very classic colonial empire ruled by Moscow. This begins with the economic exploitation of the colonies and continues with the oppression of the people of this colonial empire, even to the attempt to use their men as cannon fodder in the colonial war against Ukraine. A Europe that is interested in the security of its citizens should begin developing scenarios for a crumbling Moscow colonial empire as soon as possible. Speak softly and carry a big stick, you will go far. Europe, the European Union, simply has to relearn the principles of power politics. Incidentally, China is also considering scenarios for how to secure certain areas in today's Russian Federation if its empire falls apart. People often say that we must support other Russia. Yes, we must. At the same time, we must be fair enough to acknowledge that we can no longer find the other Russia in Russia itself. The war to conquer Ukraine is not just Putin's war. European unification was motivated by a desire for security. Given the geopolitical situation and the challenges we are facing, it is time for the European Union to develop its own foreign and security policy identity. By this, I don't just mean a coordination of 27 positions, but a real European foreign and security policy headed by an EU foreign minister. Interesting hard times need integrity to give us direction and thus hope for the further development of a free Europe. We must commit ourselves to this. Thank you very much.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I just noticed all the little like Knight of Malta symbol behind him with the Pan-Europa symbols and everything. But what lack of charisma, eh?
Yeah, so, yeah, total lack of charisma.
And yeah, the irony, like, this is a guy who wants to, like, reinstate, like, he's pushing this Pan-Europa, he wants to reinstate, like, he himself, his heart is in the Habsburg Empire, which was a colonial empire. Like, he's an imperialist, but the way he's speaking about the idea that, oh, no, it's Russia that we have to now redefine, train our minds to redefine looking at Russia, not as a country, but as a colonial empire that should actually be broken up into like 80 sub-countries with little ethno-nationalist minority groups. Each one, it's again, divide to conquer, right? And that's what Lord Curzon was doing with breaking up Bengal. It's what Mountbatten was doing with breaking up India into Pakistan. And there's just like the idea of what they want for world government is you, and this gets at what you were saying, Cynthia, earlier too, is encourage local communes, local micro democracies, like, or little micro living in the small, where people, their identity is tribal. You only live with your tribe that has maybe like an alpha leader, like in Waterworld or some dystopic movie, right? Some like chief that can manage you. But the actual power that's shaping all of the millions of little micro communities, little micro nations and city states, that's actually something nobody's allowed to even really think about, that exerts the real power top down.
Brave New World.
Totally Brave New World, yeah. So this is like, I think the fight right now is, like you said, reviving the American system, looking at the community of other nations that want to reject depopulation and go for cooperation instead, Russia, China, India, who are targeted for this new crusade, they have to be seen more as our allies in this sense, because they don't want to kill their populations. They don't want to end their ancient civilizational heritage. They want to build big things for the future. And God willing, patriots in America around Trump are able to like work with that fast before these assholes are able to like kick over the chessboard and create their false flag or whatever.
Well, so the two like white pills that I'll leave you with are this. One, over the past 5 years, Trump's key allies, and I would describe his key allies as the Arabs. Like, he really reiterated that today during the press conference with Netanyahu, is that his real friends and his real allies are the Gulf states. They've been the ones going around and subverting the agenda that y'all have been laying out tonight with bilateral agreements. They've been the ones who've been basically stepping outside of these like trade regulation, like regulatory bodies, and going to the countries and being like, hey, we have trillions of dollars that we're looking to invest. How can we invest in your country? And then just sitting down and hashing out those deals one-on-one. And then, of course, Russia and China have been really reinforcing that idea, mostly by doing bilateral deals between themselves, but then also with Iran, with India, with, you know, within the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So that's number one. The other white pill, I think, is when you look at what Trump is doing. And if you look at the way the Republic, the Zionist neocon Republican Party is responding to the way that the EU and that the European countries are treating Israel right now, the way that they're all recognizing Palestine, their rhetoric right now is that they want to defund the UN. That's what they're talking about, actually pulling out of the UN now, like America leaving the UN. That's what the Republican Congress wants to do now. Now, whether that's actually going to happen or not, like, who knows? But they're talking about sanctioning the ICC, defunding the ICC, pulling funding from the UN, and basically just knocking over the whole house of cards, like taking their ball and going home. And the UN, of course, is supposed to be like the vehicle to implement like a one world government. So, you know, I see that as all a good thing. Like, this is like game theory, Trump using their love. I mean, I think their loyalty to Israel really is probably more of like a blackmail situation more than anything else. But their undying loyalty to Israel is now being weaponized against like the New World Order agenda, because the Arabs and the Russians and the Chinese have been engaging in these bilateral trade agreements with enough countries that all these countries now are siding with them, rebelling against the Zionist cause, recognizing the state of Palestine, like out of like a nod, a hat tip to the Arabs who are now investing in their countries. And then that's leading the Republican Zionists to want to defund the UN. So it's like this Ouroboros in the best possible way of like New World Order and the Zionist World Order, like eating itself.
Interesting. Well, we're living in very interesting times. So this is, I always appreciate being able to understand the contour of this weird terrain that we all have to navigate through. And the more you understand it, the better you're in a position to not fall for traps and trenches and pitfalls. And this was, I think, a really good, useful exercise for me and for everybody listening. So thank you guys so much. And for everybody watching, we'll see you again next week for Breaking History.